Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. We'll be talking through all the week's security news in just a moment, and then turning straight to this week's sponsor interview with Casey Ellis of BugCrowd. We'll cover a couple of things in that interview. We'll talk about organizations increasingly doing bug bounties on technology they use rather than just the technology they develop and maintain. And we'll also be talking about a new thing BugCrowd is doing, BugCrowd for Marketplaces. The idea there is organizations that run marketplaces like app stores or whatever, they can now get point-in-time bounties happening on third-party apps before they wind up approving them into their stores, which makes a lot of sense. And it's more evidence of a bug bounty market that's changing. More and more, we're seeing companies like BugCrowd package access to the testers on their platforms in new ways. So that is an interesting chat with Casey coming up after the week's news with Adam Boileau. But before we get going this week, I just wanted to address something quickly. Yesterday, I went and got my annual skin cancer check. And I'll often tweet about that when I go to do it because I think it's important to encourage people to go get their checks. So I tweeted from the waiting room yesterday saying, hey, you know, don't delay your skin checks. I'm waiting for mine. And then an hour or so later, I tweeted that my doctor had actually found a cancer, a basal cell carcinoma, the friendliest cancer you can get. And that's the thing, right? There is no threat to me from this type of cancer. It is 100% not a big deal. It's not even possible for this thing to kill me, even if I just leave it alone. So I tried to make that clear in my tweet, but some of you seemed a little bit concerned about me, which is really nice, but you just don't have to worry. 2 out of 3 Australians get skin cancer at some point in their lives, and basal cell carcinoma is the most common, and it's the one you want to get. But really, here's why I tweet about it. Even melanoma, which is the bad, bad, bad one, if you catch it in time, it's also not that big a deal. Hence the tweets every year when I go to get checked. So the TLDR is, I'm actually 100% fine. But you know, if you live in a place where you get some sunshine and you fit the risk profile for skin cancer, do find the time to get checked because it could save your life. An untrained eye will not spot a skin cancer until it's too late. And I had no idea I had a cancerous spot until I got checked out. So go get checked. So that's a bit of heavy stuff, but let's get on to the week's news now with Adam Boileau. And Adam, the first news story this week is there has been a breach at a contractor that apparently does a lot of work for the Russian FSB, and many of the headlines are making a big deal out of the fact that there is a Tor de-anonymization project being worked on at this contractor. Funnily enough, though, you and I spoke about the Russian government putting that project out to public tender in like 2014, so... I don't know that it's the huge news everyone thinks it is, but it is still interesting seeing a breach at an organization like this.
Yeah, I guess people don't necessarily want to see the bureaucratic reality that the Tor bypasses or Tor decloaks just get put out to tender like everything else. And yeah, it's not super exciting. Although I guess the interesting part here is that we are seeing, you know, a government contract get owned. It's certainly embarrassing, you know, both for them and for the FSB as well. I can't imagine that, the contract negotiations for the next thing that they're doing is going to be, you know, I think they're going to get favorable rates this time around, the FSB. So yes. That's, you know, saving the Russian government a ruble or two there. Yeah, it has been rather kind of blown up into, oh my God, they're getting shadow brokers by Cyber Command, and, you know, which kind of doesn't really seem the case. And
it doesn't feel like that. It feels more like angry Ukrainians, you know?
Yeah, I mean, Russia's certainly got plenty of people who are motivated, you know, plenty of enemies. You would expect a kind of a higher grade of trolling from Cybercom, you would think.
Sure, I'll take that compliment. But yeah, so I mean, that's you got to keep in mind too, the FSB is essentially a law enforcement organization. They've got much more in common with the US FBI than they do with NSA or other organizations like that. So it doesn't scan to me like global intrigue, but you know, who knows, right? Like we will find out in the fullness of time, I hope, or maybe not. NSO Group back in the news because apparently someone saw their pitch deck and they're now promoting a capability which would allow them to extract data from cloud services. That's both consumer cloud services, Apple, Google, stuff like that, Facebook, but also Amazon and Microsoft services. So it is kind of an interesting thing for them to be promoting. And I do wonder if it would be legally problematic for them.
Yeah, we have seen some write-ups of this kind of lose a bit of the nuance that, you know, what they're proposing here is not, you know, tooling that would directly break into Amazon or Microsoft or Google to steal data from their customers' clouds accounts, but instead like an extension to their mobile malware that knows enough about, you know, how to pull Amazon tokens out of the Amazon mobile app, for example, or how to pull things out of Google Cloud or Google Drive apps on your phone, and then extend the collection from documents stored on the phone up to documents stored up in the cloud services that are accessible from their phone, which, you know, seems like the sort of feature that you would expect a high-end piece of mobile malware to have. But yeah, the legal aspects, in terms of, you know, kind of crossing jurisdictions.
Well, and just terms of service as well, right?
Well, I mean, that of course, yeah, but I don't know whether NSO group are particularly worried about those. Maybe they will be if they get a whole bunch of lawyers up in their face. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that will do it. Funnily enough, too, I had heard about that a couple of months ago, and I actually tipped a journalist that I know who works for a major publication who contacted NSO about it, and of course they denied it. So that's interesting, right? So that one has been out there for a while, just saying. Hal Martin got 9 years. This is, of course, the guy who was hoarding 50 terabytes worth of very sensitive NSA material in his garage or whatever. For a while, he was sort of thought to be maybe a source of shadow brokers material, but it looks less and less likely that that was the case. But still, he got 9 years. Not such a surprise, because from memory, that's what the prosecution was looking for anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the moral of the story is perhaps don't hoard top secret stuff at your house, because I mean, even if you don't end up getting it stolen or getting it lost, someone else may, and then the resulting investigation might just find you as well, which I think seems to be the narrative about Hal Martin, you know, versus the other guy who was, you know, kind of perhaps more likely to be the shadow broker source.
Yeah, that was Nghia Huang Pho, I think, from memory, was his name. And that one, he certainly looks more like he might have been the person who got his stuff owned into the possession of the shadow brokers. I did read some other reporting on the Hal Martin thing where he gave a really weird statement at his sentencing, and he seems like a very strange fellow. His defense lawyers were trying to argue that he was like a hoarder and, you know, that it was like a compulsion, but prosecutors weren't buying it because they say his place was way too organized for him to actually suffer from some sort of hoarding condition. But that's it. 9 years for Hal Martin. You know, he'll be out in however long he's been in custody, a while. So that's done, right? We can draw a line under that one. Great headline from Wired. If you think FaceApp is scary, wait till you hear about Facebook. Of course, this is a reaction to everyone freaking out over people using FaceApp. That's the app where most people have been using it to make themselves, you know, to generate an older version of their own face. And there's been a lot of panic over the fact that this is a Russian-owned app. It seems a little bit overblown, and this headline and story captures that nicely.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the mainstream coverage and a lot of the Twitter kind of, you know, hand-wringing has been, you know, perhaps poorly informed. I mean, yes, it's a Russian company. Yes, it is uploading your data into actually AWS, it turned out, as opposed to, you know, directly into Russia somewhere. But yes, even if, you know, people ought to be more worried about other things like Facebook, for example, the fact that we're talking about, you know, and that people are thinking about, where does my data go when I stick it in this app? Should I be worried about that? What does it mean? Did I read the terms of service? What do they mean? Like, that's a good conversation to have, even if in the big picture, and is not necessarily the right thing. It's still, you know, better than, you know, randomly installing anything and just getting on with it without thinking.
Yeah, no, I agree. Last week, of course, we spoke about the Galileo outage. Lily Hay Newman is reporting for Wired that outage is now fixed. But of course, it served as a bit of a warning, right? Something to think about when you have a 1 week outage in a satellite positioning network.
Yeah, we're very lucky, of course, that, you know, all the current Galileo receivers are also GPS receivers, and I imagine in nearly all cases anyway, and we're capable of just falling back to GPS and kind of carrying on. If this had happened with the main US GPS network, I mean, we would just be screwed. I mean, everything would just, I mean, nothing would work, right? Everything relies on satellite timing and positioning data. And yeah, having an outage of a system like Galileo, even this early on in its cycle, is useful because it does make us think about it. And, you know, they haven't been particularly forthcoming about, you know, the root cause yet, but, you know, we may still see a, you know, a wrap up of exactly what went wrong, you know, with their timing signals. But still, like, we're just so reliant on satellite networks, satellite, you know, navigation and timing networks, that anything that makes us think twice about that is good.
Yeah, there's going to be a run on sextants, basically, in light of this this satellite network failure.
Makes me glad we've got a cesium clock in the office, just in case.
Just in case, right? Who doesn't? Of course, everyone's got three.
Got one of those.
Yeah, the NSA is establishing a defense-minded division, and it's going to be called the Cybersecurity Directorate. I think this is a division that is going to have a wider remit than IAD, which was the NSA Information Assurance Division, which did stuff like release hardened patches for Linux and whatever, and guidance on security. This looks like it's an attempt to really build a unit of NSA that's going to interface more directly with the private sector, with that sort of more holistic mission of looking after the cybersecurity of critical interests in the United States, which seems like a good thing.
Yeah, it does seem like a good thing. I mean, the old school kind of NSA mindset that was much more, much less,
such agency.
Exactly, right? It was less open to cooperation. It's not really the right approach anymore. And I think that, kind of shaking things up internally. I'm not sure about the politics necessarily inside of it, but I'm sure they've been thinking a lot about how best to interface with, the rest of the public sector, all of the private enterprise, and of course also interact with, the Cyber Command and the other kind of changes in the rest of the American cyber infrastructure, which of course, is still pretty world leading in terms of, the work that it does, because America is such a center of the tech world.
Yeah, we'll just have to see if this results in a lot more stuff being pumped through to VirusTotal. I mean, I have a feeling that that's kind of the direction we're heading in, where a lot of these SIGINT agencies have realized, and, this is a conversation I've had with people who work in that sort of area. They've kind of realized that they can't afford to be these secret agencies anymore that don't engage with the public sphere, because so much of what is critical to a nation these days sits in the private sector, right? Like they have to get out there, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, they do. And if they want to get buy-in from everybody outside of those agencies, they do have to be open to sharing, like not just hoovering up data, that they've collected either through SIGINTing or through, through people volunteering information to them. They have to be willing to give something back. And, I think that is being recognized.
Yeah, interesting one here. CISA in the United States, that's the DHS sort of cyber agency. They have scored a bit of a win here when it comes to the .gov domain name space because, there was all of that stuff with Sea Turtle, which I erroneously linked to Iran last week. Sorry about that. That was I got them confused with DN Espionage, which is a very similar crew doing very similar stuff, which is thought to be Iran-backed activity. Sea Turtle, no one really knows. There's rumors, but no one really knows. In order to combat those types of attacks, the US government has made a change, which essentially means, Adam, I believe if there is a change to the DNS record of a .gov domain, the domain owner will actually get an email. Is that right? I mean, it's just a simple change, but it seems like a sensible one.
Yeah, it's not a sophisticated control, but, if your DNS gets changed and you didn't change it, then that's probably a thing you want to know about. Doesn't have to be sophisticated to work well.
Yeah, that's right. US Cyber Command having a lot of fun and games. They just ran a simulated seaport attack, cyber attack, to test digital readiness, according to this story from Shannon Vavra at CyberScoop. Sounds like fun, I got to say.
It does sound like a fun exercise. I mean, like 650 people from, US and a bunch of the other Five Eyes countries get together and, they had a fake seaport and they ran a whole bunch of exercises where a group of them were trying to break into it, disrupt shipping operations and that kind of thing. And then the rest of them were attempting to kind of, run the fence and do hunt and throw people out of that environment. The thing I always find funny about these is, whilst it's really good to exercise, I mean, anything that drills this capability is really useful, often it doesn't say what the outcome of it was. And in this case, it's rather left unsaid. And I fear that means that the people who are on offense did not get affected and correctly managed to stop the port from shipping stuff and everything was terrible.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing that I wonder about when I read about exercises like these is I'm guessing most seaports don't have a team of 20 threat hunters sitting on standby, right?
And by the time 500 of them in this case.
Yeah, and by the time there's a problem, it's probably too late to really do anything meaningful about it. I mean, I don't think that makes exercises like this useless, but you see what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, the exercises are obviously, not exactly inspired by, exercises, of course, are inspired by actual events, but yeah, the reality probably would be a little bit different.
Yeah, well, yay. Some interesting comments from FBI Director Christopher Wray. He was speaking to Congress. He says that cyber threats are outpacing the FBI's capacity to track them, which is, it is kind of a intuitive thing, right? Like that's not so surprising. But he has some interesting ideas on how the FBI can best tackle cybercrime, and it's not going to mean just leaving it to field officers to investigate individual crimes.
Yeah, I think the traditional remit of the FBI, of course, is investigating individual crimes. And now there's cyber involved in a bunch of those crimes. So they've gotten pretty good at doing that. But it kind of makes sense now to look at, you know, what are the individual criminal groups? What are they going to do in the future? And kind of operate on a more, you know, more holistic level. And also to draw upon, you know, the bunch of the skills that the FBI have in their field offices and use those across the organization, not necessarily, you know, in individual cases in individual regions. He's also, of course, asking for more money. It's going to cost a bunch. I think asking for, what, $70 more million and a bunch more staff as well to try and deal with this. But yeah, I mean, the FBI, you know, has had to learn a lot since the, you know, the freaking days of the 80s and 90s, you know, and now that they're, you know, right at the pointy end of a bunch more than just straight up criminal investigations.
Well, when you look at what's happening to American local governments when it comes to ransomware and various colleges, and, you know, they've got a real ransomware problem at the moment, and you're not going to, you know, you're not going to solve that problem by leaving it to field officers to respond to individual incidents. They really do need to get serious about tackling those crime rings like they would crime rings in, say, narco trafficking or something like that.
Yeah, it certainly is a different kind of landscape than just individual piecemeal crimes these days.
Yeah, it is. Bill Barr, the United States Attorney General, delivered a time warp speech. Really? Yeah. He was at the International Conference on Cybersecurity. And yeah, he delivered this speech that came out of a time vortex from like 5 years ago, talking about how encryption is hindering law enforcement. You know, what's your take on this one?
Yeah, it did. It felt like they just got the speech from 5 years ago out of the thing, kind of brushed it off, handed it to him, because it really didn't take into account the kind of changes in, I mean, we had Jim Baker on the show a while ago, you know, kind of talking about the extent to which the FBI does understand, you know, law enforcement in general does understand, you know, the changes in the landscape that they're operating in and the various techniques and ways they can approach, you know, encrypted devices and the going dark problem. But yeah, this didn't really seem like it reflected much of that modern, you know, more nuanced modern understanding.
No, I mean, it's more like encryption's bad. Prime numbers exactly. Bad.
Let's get some, you know, key escrow and clipper chips all up and everything. But yeah, it doesn't do them any favors when they don't, you know, when they're seen to be not engaging with, you know, the current state of things.
No, and look, I've said it a million times, like both sides of this debate need to just, you know, get it together, right? Basically, yeah. What else? Oh, man, we reported on that data breach in Bulgaria last week. 5 out of 7, information on 5 out of 7 Bulgarians had apparently been obtained by someone who it turns out was a 20-year-old pen tester, which is like, and they're not going to have a good time. But some of that data has now been exposed and is all over the internet, and I'm not quite sure how much in terms of number of people affected, but I believe it is 10 gig of that data. And Adam, there is an interesting story behind how that data came to be exposed.
Yeah, so the 20-year-old pen tester who originally stole the data didn't appear to have leaked it to, you know, where it is now floating around in public. But he did send kind of like an extortion mail, you know, demanding that people free Julian. I don't exactly know what the Bulgarian Ministry of Finance is going to do about Julian Assange. But anyway, he sent through this kind of extortion mail. And the Bulgarian TV, one of the Bulgarian TV news channels, ran a piece about it. And they had a screenshot of the email with the URL that the guy had sent to demonstrate that he had access to the data. It was like an encrypted zip. Some enterprising hacker typed the URL from the media broadcaster into his browser, downloaded the zip file, cracked the password, and then uploaded it to a bunch of hacker forums. And now something like half the data that got nicked is just floating around out there.
Yeah, so this guy worked for a company called TAD Group and went rogue, which is not a real nice thing to do to your boss. And as a boss of pen testers, Adam, I'd imagine if one of your guys tried to do something like this, you would fire them into the sun.
There would be, the back of my hand would be, you know, they'd be swift. They would be in trouble, let's just say
they would be in trouble. But that wouldn't happen because all of the Insomnia people are very above board.
Exactly.
Very above board. Ars Technica wrote up this thing. This is really interesting, right? So it turns out there's this company called Nacho Analytics, and the data they offer is, so they obtain a bunch of visited URL information from plugins for Chrome, and then they package that data up to offer analytics to people based on like websites that they might be interested in. Like, you know, what does the typical reader profile for the New York Times look like? Might be a question that these guys could answer. I don't know the precise details of their offerings, but it's that sort of thing. Turns out these plugins were not only recording URLs that people were visiting, but it was also scraping, URLs from pages visited. And some of those links could be used as a direct object reference to retrieve things that were quite sensitive. We're talking people's tax information, medical information, that is, of course, being improperly stored. But that's not really the point. The point is, almost accidentally, they've wound up with this cache of really, really sensitive information on millions of people. And now this story is out and it's all, it's all pretty damn interesting, isn't it?
The story is set off by some guy that, was looking at some of the add-ons in his browser and started kind of wondering why it was doing a particular thing, pulled the thread, many months later, had kind of uncovered the technical side of how, data was being collected, by various browser add-ons, sent off to data aggregators, and then ending up, in places where they were publicly available. But also, the sort of the business model and all of the kind of relationships between the parties. And it's a really interesting, very modern kind of data supply chain or data kind of management sort of story. And, the company that ended up with this Nacho Analytics, like their business model of selling like third-party analytics, like where you can, like normally when you have analytics, right, you're looking at people who visit your site and you're collecting the analytics data on your site and then reading it yourself. This was collecting analytics data, independently from other people and then selling it so that I can go buy analytics on my competitor's site, which is kind of a, shady business model. And it did seem like there's a bunch of terms of service, for the various browser add-ons and then, these services that kind of make it, say, okay, well, the data's being collected and given to third parties, but that's not really enough to understand, for the average person, what the impact of that is. And there's, examples of, people's home security cameras, for example, where the URLs have all of the necessary information to view a live feed of your house. That's just on the internet for someone to buy. Like, that's not an outcome that anyone who is using, some browser plugin that lets you zoom GIFs, kind of expected from that. So it's
things like travel itineraries hosted on Priceline, booking.com, airline websites, and funny ones, other weird edge cases like Facebook photos, even when the photos are set to private, because of course the CDN URLs are in there, right? And that's a way to get those things. So it is a really interesting case study, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think, the main thing to take away from this is there's just no safe way to have any add-ons in your browser, and you should just not do it at all, because you just can't tell, right, these kind of third order, kind of collection efforts. You don't know where the data is going to end up. And that's, kind of what I guess drove this guy on was to understand that big picture. And the fact that it takes someone, months of work to figure out what the impact of installing like a couple of browser add-ons is just ridiculous.
It is. Google, as predicted, Google has given dark matter certificates. Dark matter, of course, is the UAE contractor that was embroiled in a bit of a controversy over the so-called Project Raven thing that was unveiled by Reuters. Dark matter certificates have been given the boot from Chrome and Android following Mozilla's decision to do just that, or to decline them, a root certificate in the browser. So, this is much as we expected, right? It just seems that like people kind of default to following Mozilla on these types of decisions.
Yeah, to their credit, Mozilla do seem to do a pretty good job of this. It's nice having some accountability, and it's kind of good that we do see the main vendors, Apple, Microsoft, Google, that provide trust stores in their software, following suit from Mozilla. We wouldn't want to get into a position where the root CA stores really strongly started to diverge from each other, and of course also a bunch of Linux distributions use the Mozilla root store as what they bundle when they ship a trust store as well. But yeah, it's interesting that Mozilla is leading the pack here. And yeah, it's good that Google has followed suit, and we should see the same from Apple and Microsoft soon.
Yeah, well, and it's great if you're one of those big companies that you just don't need to think about this anymore. You just like, just do what Mozilla does, that's fine. Yeah. And then you don't have to get accused of being politically weird and shady when you make a decision that's different to theirs.
Yeah, exactly. You get to blame Mozilla for the political fallout rather than having to wear it yourself, or indeed do all the cost yourself.
So, yeah, and Mozilla are a bunch of hippies, right? So they're not going to be criticized in the same way as Microsoft for making the same decision. So high fives all around. Someone has published some research which will apparently help people to understand RDP in a way that will help them write exploits for the so-called Bluekeep vulnerability. So this research now is doing the rounds, and apparently, if people can download this research, it will, yeah, it will really make writing an exploit for that RDP bug a lot easier. And I would note too that Canvas, the latest version of Canvas, just shipped from Immunity, and they say they have a module in it that exploits the RDP bug called Bluekeep. So yeah, it does look like eventually, like sometime soon, we're going to see a public exploit for this one, and Immunity customers already have one.
Yeah, there's certainly a few exploits out there. Everyone's keeping them pretty under their hat. But yeah, the Immunity guys kind of know what they're doing. And if that one's out there, I'm sure it works pretty well. Clearly, it is pretty exploitable. They're good at that kind of thing over there.
Yes. Well, you used to work for them doing that, didn't you?
I did. Used to be the dev lead on Canvas over at Immunity. So, you know. but yeah, there was a presentation at a conference in China where a guy from Tencent's Keen Lab, who are particularly good at this sort of bug, did a presentation talking through all of the things, the engineering aspects that you'd need to know to build an exploit for this, you know, kind of the heap spray, enough of the RDP protocol to understand how to heap spray with it. And, you know, those are the kind of main hurdles, according to people who have written exploits for this. Those are the main hurdles you need to kind of get across to be able to turn up a working exploit. The slide deck did also suggest that it was a live demo. We haven't seen the exploit code, of course, even though there's a few proof of concept, a few scripts that can detect the presence of the bug remotely floating around, but I haven't seen an actual exploit yet other than what's in Canvas.
Police in the UK and the Netherlands, they've sort of created an intervention campaign for young offenders who are committing cybercrimes, right? So if you're between the age of 12 and 23 years old, the idea is they can divert you into, you know, a rehabilitation program instead of dragging you through the courts and throwing you in the clink. Seems like pretty sensible thinking.
Yeah, it does. This does seem like a much more nuanced approach, shall we say, than just throwing people in jail for doing, you know, essentially really stupid things where there isn't a whole bunch of harm. And obviously, you know, there's a continuum from, you know, Dread Pirate Roberts ordering hits to, you know, kids hacking their school's attendance system or something like that.
To people in the middle like Marcus Hutchins, who have clearly reformed but kind of did something bad and not quite sure what should happen.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly some people who should face some consequences. But yeah, if you're a punk kid hacking your school thing, then being, you know, having it explained to you that there are some consequences to that, but that there are also a bunch of career options and really cool things you can do, like that's going to change a bunch of people's lives much more effectively than throwing them in jail and turning them into future criminals.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a great networking opportunity, isn't it? If you're a criminal, exactly, put them right in prison with all the real criminals, and just seems like a dumb approach, right? And we've often been critical of the United States approach to prosecuting that type of crime, right? And just going all out berserk on everyone all the time. This approach seems like one that will probably wind up achieving a better result for society, because you're going to have well-adjusted people with good skills and who don't have criminal records who are able to make a contribution. So I think it's good. Lorenzo over at Vice has tracked down his old mate, Phineas Fisher, who has denied that he is working for the Russian government. And of course, that rumor was first sort of floated in Joseph Menn's book about CDC. But of course, Adam, if Phineas Fisher was a Russian agent, they probably wouldn't admit it to Lorenzo.
or would they? Because everything's so backwards these days. That's like, who even knows? Like, the confusion doctrine is very strong. Like, maybe he would just come out and say, "I'm a Russian shill," and then we'd all be like, "But is he really a Russian shill?"
That's right. Or is this a misinformation? Is this some sort of form of deception? But that's right, isn't it? Who knows, right? Like, it is impossible to know. And I'm just so personally intrigued by the whole Phineas Fisher thing, because I just really do wonder, because it could be anyone from an activist to a group of people working for a SIGINT agency, and we have no idea.
I know, it's so crazy, the world now. I mean, you know, I guess I kind of feel like it's an activist, like it feels like one to me, but we have no idea.
Feels like an activist in a way that Guardians of Peace and Gucci for Two never did. so if it is a front, they're doing a good job.
Right? Yeah, it's an above average front if it is.
Yes, indeed. Equifax fined $700 million, which is, you know, I mean, to you and me, sounds like a bunch of money. I mean, the fine is up to $700 million. You add this to the GDPR fines, the proposed GDPR fines for various data breaches that we're seeing across Europe, and it starts to look like regulators are getting serious about coming down on companies that have been careless and allowed their data to get out.
Yeah, I mean, I would have liked to have seen Equifax get an even bigger stick, I think. I mean, a credit bureau just really has no excuse in losing all of its data and, you know, compared to, what, $5 billion for Facebook, although they shrugged that off as well. So, I mean, I don't think Equifax's share price has tanked as a result of this. I think perhaps it's even less than they had budgeted. And it's only, like, what, $2 or $3 per person in
the US.
But it's
a lot of people. Come on.
it's still a lot of people, yes. But I don't know. I would have liked to see a big one. But on the other hand, right, $700 million is still a lot more than it would have cost to patch your stupid Java Struts web app in the first place.
Yeah, I think it's a big enough number that it'll get the attention of people on boards, right? And that's what fines like this are designed to do. And I think it might be enough to do that, you would think.
Well, you'd certainly hope so. I mean, you know, we are seeing regulators really start to just show that they have very little tolerance for really large-scale important data breaches, especially at like that kind of organization, you know, credit bureau. It's just not acceptable anymore. And, you know, the sticks will probably get bigger if they keep screwing it up.
There is a talk coming up at Black Hat by a bunch of researchers from DevCore, Orange Tsai and Meh Chang. They're outlining some bugs in corporate VPN concentrators, stuff from Fortinet, Palo Alto, and Pulse, and, you know, just embarrassing bugs, really.
Yeah, this is just really bad. I mean, these are, you know, corporate appliances that are designed to go on the internet and provide a security function. And to see stuff like format string bugs in the case of the Palo Alto Networks one, like their SSL VPN, like that's just not good enough. Like that's a dead bug class. And there's no excuse for a security vendor to be pulling that kind of rubbish now. And, you know, especially when if you own one of these things, right, you can sniff all the things going across it. You can steal the creds of it. You can impersonate other people onto the network from it. Like it's just a really, really great place to enter the network, you know, way better than phishing. I say that having entered a few VPN concentrators on occasion. And it's just, it's just bad. It's so bad.
Yeah, Mudge was on, there's a couple of things about this one that stand out. First is that they silently patched it, which has got them an absolute shellacking over the Twitters over the last few days. Old mate Mudge was being pretty critical on Twitter as well, saying that, you know, we've seen bugs like this from Palo Alto pop up fairly regularly. And it's not just that they have some code quality issues, but, you know, they've picked some really risky architectures like Linux on MIPS, right? And that's probably Linux. Not good enough, right? So, God, you would just hope that...
We don't need no exploit mitigation tech. Who needs non-executable stacks or whatever?
Yeah. You know, and you'd think like Palo Alto, like they've got really smart people there. You'd think that they would have moved on from this sort of stuff, but apparently, nope.
No, and they're not patching, like they're silently patching. I think that just really aggravates me. I mean, they've just got no excuse to silently do this. I mean, they... You know, there's a whole bunch of people who won't be applying the patches because they don't look critical, and yet it turns out they're going to get them owned. Like, for a security vendor, that's just not good enough.
Yeah, a bit of transparency, please. Oh, this next story is absolutely hilarious. Catalan filed it for ZDNet. There was a contractor for Siemens. His name is David Tinley. He's 62 years old. He's from a city near Pittsburgh, and he was running a great little racket there for a while, Adam.
So apparently, he used to work for Siemens and he worked on some spreadsheets that they use for managing, you know, logistics or deliveries or whatever else. And of course, like all corporate spreadsheets, that's filled with VBA and other obscure functions that make it all work. When he finished employment there, he left a little present in the VBA script such that it would occasionally just stop working. And they'd have to give poor old David a call, get him to come in on contract and fix up the problems. Pretty neat scheme you got going on there, buddy.
Yes, and it all unraveled when I think another contractor got a hand on his code and it was like what he'd done had just stuck out like the dog's proverbials, as we would say. And now he's facing up to 10 years in prison and a fine of $250,000. So sucks
at
to
age
be
62,
you.
Maybe you don't get to go to a little, you know, rehabilitation class like the kids in Europe. So.
You should probably know better. You should probably know better. This is a funny one, Adam. We spoke recently about a Jira bug, also about a bug in the XIM mail agent. Someone's going around like dropping crypto miners on vulnerable boxes, but don't worry because they're doing it for the good of the internet.
Yeah, if you go and investigate why your box is running at 100% CPU load and you go and read the source for the thing that's doing it, there's a text file that basically says, you know, we're doing this to help the internet. You know, if you want us to remove it, just let us know. We're just mining Monero. We're not encrypting your data and trying to ransom you. We're good guys, honest.
Yeah, now that's an amazing bit of self-deception there, isn't it? Truly impressive. This is an interesting one by Shannon Vavra over at CyberScoop. Microsoft has apparently notified 10,000 customers within the past year that they have been targeted by state-backed attackers. That seems like a pretty high number, right? Like, I know it's 2019 and everything, but still, that's a lot of activity.
Yeah, it certainly is. And
I mean, and that's just the stuff they're detecting as well.
Right? Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, obviously there's a lot of people targeting a lot of things. Microsoft does have a lot of customers. So perhaps the 10,000 number is not, I mean, it's not astronomical. I suppose I would almost expect more in a way. What I would like to see is Microsoft said that, you know, some of which are successful. I'd like to know which ones. I'd also like to know how they're figuring it out, like what sort of, you know, kind of attribution they're using. You know, I'd like to see their workings. That's the, you know, obviously, they don't necessarily want to share all of that because, you know, the groups that are doing it are also interested in how they get detected. But I know I'd be interested.
Well, you know, anyone at Microsoft who wants to shine a little light on that for Adam, you can email editorial at risky.biz and, you know, we can set a meeting. It sounds like a bit of a plan. Mozilla is adding a Tor mode. I mean, this is something that we spoke about a while ago, that there was a plan for Mozilla to add like a Tor-based incognito mode into the browser. It looks like that's going to start off as a browser add-on before it gets merged into the core browser.
Yeah, I mean, this makes sense. It lets them kind of start at a smaller scale, both for Firefox in terms of the code changes, but also for the Tor network as a whole, before really trying to go, you know, full hog. And, you know, that would drastically increase the number of, you know, people on the Tor network. If even, you know, like if every private browsing session in Firefox was a full Tor node, like that would be a pretty significant change. You know, this gives them a chance to experiment with it a bit more slowly. And even if it doesn't end up being the mainline, you know, private browsing mode or super private, whatever they're going to call it. I know even that isn't the end game that ends up happening. There's a bunch of other work trying to integrate, you know, some of the changes that the Tor project were making to support Tor browser bundle on Firefox's, you know, kind of long-term support branch that are being integrated into Firefox in general. So, I mean, even, yeah, it may benefit Tor even without the full hog, you know, perfect solution.
Yeah, I mean, I remember talking to Roger Dingledine at a conference like many, many, many years ago, and this has always been kind of the goal for him, right? So that's interesting. Another change happening at Firefox is they are going to integrate. Some time ago, they announced that they were doing a have I been pwned integration in the browser where you type a password and it sends over hashes to have I been pwned and sort of figures out if that password appears in any data breaches. They've taken that a step further and they're now going to check your stored credentials against have I been pwned. It seems like simple stuff that's probably going to get us a fair way, right? In terms of improving the security of the average user.
Yeah, it does give some tools to a user that doesn't even know to ask that question. So the sort of people who would check by with have I been pwned themselves are already security conscious. And so, yeah, extending that to people who don't know that's a thing they should do or could do, you know, is a really useful benefit. And this is another example of Mozilla's approach of kind of taking those add-on features and pushing them into the mainline browser where they can really benefit the full audience rather than just the kind of the sort of people who'd install add-ons for security reasons.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Firefox seem to be doing some really interesting stuff at the moment. So
They do need to differentiate themselves, I guess, from, you know, Chrome and Safari and even IE to a certain extent, or Edge these days.
Yeah, that's it. Microsoft has released an SDK for voting machines, and it looks like just an awesome idea, given that the voting machine manufacturers don't seem to know what the hell they're doing, a lot of them. So for a company like Microsoft to have really thought through the challenges here just involved in voting machines and to release an SDK that allows them to, you know, make their machines run, this just seems fantastic. It's called Election Guard, and it's, you know, they've just announced it.
Yeah, this does seem like a pretty good project. I mean, Microsoft's been known for doing a bunch of research stuff over the years that doesn't necessarily have direct commercial outcomes for them. And this is just a great place for them to be, you know, putting their expertise into an area that's just going to benefit, you know, a whole bunch of people. You know, digital election machines are not really the place where elections get compromised. I think that we've kind of learned that over the last few years. The actual machines themselves are not the core issue, but it's also a thing that we do need to get right so that it doesn't become a problem in the future. And it sounds like they've sat down and done a bunch of the kind of crypto donkey work to come up with a technique where, you know, the votes are recorded cryptographically so they can't necessarily be observed. You can't assert to somebody else that you voted a certain way after the fact, but also that they can count it. and also, you know, kind of allow a way for people to verify, like all of the things that crypto nerds felt like they could do, but was never going to happen when it was a, you know, Diebold Windows XP machine with an MS Jet database, you know, that kind of,
yeah,
well, the standard approach to a voting machine. So it's really good seeing them kind of think through.
Yeah, yeah. And look, I mean, regular listeners would have probably noticed by now that we don't tend to cover many election, you know, voting machine security stories for the reason that you just mentioned, which is like, you know, the attacks are going to probably happen somewhere else. I mean, that's not to say that some adversary couldn't, you know, fiddle with one booth and make the results look weird to cast doubt on an election. But, you know, there are bigger vulnerabilities elsewhere, but it is still a problem that needed to be solved. And this looks like a pretty big step in the right direction. So well done, Microsoft. Now, flipping from biscuit to no biscuit, the government in Kazakhstan is now intercepting all HTTPS traffic. If you want to get on the internet there and use HTTPS, you need to install a government certificate. And that is being mandated by all ISPs. So, yeesh, pretty grim.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what you're supposed to do about this. I mean, you know, if your government decides that you have to install the CIA, otherwise you don't get to use the internet, you don't really have a whole bunch of choice. I mean, you can try and VPN over the top, or you can try and tunnel it, but in the end, like, that's not a scalable thing that more than a few people can do, right? We know if we saw really widespread circumvention, that of course they're going to go and deal with that. And we've seen how effective, you know, sort of machine learning and metadata analysis techniques have been in China. It's absolutely a thing that they can probably just go buy from the Chinese if they need it. So I don't know what you do other than, you know, you're just kind of screwed if you're in Kazakhstan and you want to have any sort of privacy from your government. I mean,
yeah, no, I mean, that, look, it is simply the case that this can be done, and it can be done quite easily now, which is troubling. It's just amazing when you see a headline like that, which just said, no more real HTTPS in an entire country, and that's just that.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly beyond where it's a technical problem, right? This is this is outside of the scope of technical security people and way off into politics now.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Slack has reset passwords for 1% of its users. And this one is about as clear as mud, right? It looks like some passwords were revealed by a bug bounty participant. They sort of found a bit of a stash of Slack creds. And of course, Slack's initial response was saying, oh, well, these people probably had keyloggers on their device. But then it looks like all of those people had something else in common, which is they all used those passwords during a set time frame in 2015 when Slack had suffered a breach. So it looks like the more likely situation here is someone had enough access into Slack systems to be doing some real-time cred harvesting. Is that what it looks like to you as well?
That's certainly my reading of it, eh? And the blog post or the news post from Slack about this was pretty weaselly on the subject. I mean, it's a lot of focus on the, oh, only 1% of the user base has to reset their passwords as a precaution, and only people who've used it ages ago, and it kind of really doesn't say what they mean, which is, like, if there's a stash of clear text creds and the root cause was they came out during a compromise, it's because someone was logging creds, you know, in their login pipeline. And that's, you know, that's not a thing that they said at the time when they triaged that 2015 breach. And I mean, given how much people rely on Slack for so many things beyond just, you know, idle gossiping, right? There's all sorts of chat ops systems that glue into Slack and all of the scrollback history and all the priv mess. It's just like, Slack's a really juicy target. And the fact that someone was up in there logging clear text creds for we don't know how long.
Well, I mean, they might have been piping overly verbose logs into some log file that the attacker
got a hold of. Of course, right. There's other things that could have happened, but yeah. I would just really like them to be a little more clear about what's going on, even though it's, you know, 4 years ago, just because, you know they're a target, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I want a shell on that box.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you could find out, especially as a pen tester, right? As an attacker, you're going to get all sorts of interesting stuff, right? So especially stuff. Keeping an eye on ops, like while you're doing an attack, know, right? If you can be in their Slack.
Yeah, like watching them having their crisis meetings. Like, I mean, we've done that, right? But we've done that through stealing credentials and logging in or making our own accounts from the admin panel or whatever else, rather than through the infrastructure. But that's just scope, right? It's because we're not allowed to.
Yeah, but if you were working for a government, why not?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if we weren't restricted by scope, then off we go.
Goddamn scope making you adhere to things like laws.
I know, it's so unreasonable. So unreasonable.
Absolutely sucks. Business email compromise scams are ticking along at the moment. Latest figures suggest $301 million per month in illegal transfers are occurring. That's a lot of money. That's big bickies, right? And it's just such a dumb crime type that it just, the mind boggles.
Well, you know, it's not dumb if it works, right? And $300 million a month, like that's working. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and that's up from like $110 million a month in 2016. So this is getting worse.
Yeah. Now, that's I think, the most interesting part of this. I mean, the fact that it's big money is not a surprise. But, yeah, the trend of growing 100% a year, that should be pretty concerning. We do see a lot of pretty high-profile people getting – you know, getting themselves business email compromised. I mean, that one we covered last week with the defense contractor shipping classified stuff to a fake Navy base because of email compromise. But it wasn't even compromised. That was just bad email.
You know, fake
email addresses. But
that was just saying, hey, I'm Navy procurement guy at gmail.com. Please send me your top secret classified stuff, right?
Oh, dear. But yeah, it's one of those things that it's a classic whole system problem, right? Where, you can't solve this with any one technical control, and it's clearly making someone a lot of money, and it's clearly going to keep on getting bigger and bigger until, you know, we do something a bit differently, and we can't just solve it with, you know, spam filters or something like that.
No, it really is, there's a technical component to it, but mostly it is a business process security issue, right? Like that's where the vulnerability is. Those numbers came to us via the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, and Bleeping Computer had the report on that one. Moving on, we saw some malicious Python libraries removed from PyPy. Not the biggest supply chain attack, but it's interesting that these things are just still ticking along at a fairly regular beat.
Yeah, I mean, certainly we see this in all of the various open source supply chains, you know, Ruby Gems and Perl CPAN once upon a time, if anyone still uses that. And of course, you know, the various Node JavaScript repositories. But the Python one doesn't seem to have quite so much malicious code, but I think that's just, you know, because smaller scale compared to the Node ecosystem. But yeah, clearly there is still malicious code in there for you to go and find.
Now, look, we all remember the Bloomberg story, the big hack. Rice-sized chips glued to motherboards to fiddle with the BMC. Turns out, you know, you don't really need the rice-sized chips, do you, Adam? And this next story is proof. Walk us through it. It's staggering.
Yeah, so a couple of security researchers found some bugs in a an OEM manufacturer of software for baseball management controllers. In this case, they had a bug that was like remote code exec, if you can talk to the BMC, like remote in the sense that you're talking across the bus to the chip as opposed to, I don't think it was on the network. And also another one in the firmware update process where the firmware updates weren't signed. And obviously, if you're in a position where you've owned a system and you can then also escalate up into the baseboard management controller, you can persist across reinstall of the box, which, you know, if you're a serious business operator, then that's totally a thing that you want to do.
I mean, we were just talking about how, like, it would have been a nightmare trying to evict Cyber Command from Iranian systems. And, you know, it's stuff like this. This is the reason why, right? Like, this is a great way to basically perma-own people so that they either have to reflash their BMCs, and even then, do they trust that the reflash was successful, or they just have to throw them in the bin?
Yeah, I mean, a whole bunch of machines in Iran getting put in the shredder, I am sure, and then they've got to go procure new ones through whatever, you know, sanction-busting process. In this particular case, the OEM BMC components were being used by Lenovo and Gigabyte as the primary customers. Of course, there's a bunch of other downstreams that will probably crop up as well. The funny thing, though, of course, is that Lenovo declined to fix the software update one with, you know, lack of signature verification because apparently at the time that those chips were put in place, like back in 2014, it wasn't best practice, and they're just not going to fix it, and it's just end of life and tough deal with it.
So why would you need to solder rice-sized chips when you can just make people use this crap and then refuse to fix it? I mean, this seems like the best type of supply chain infiltration.
Well, it gets the job done, right? And certainly, yeah, isn't going to get caught by people looking for grains of rice.
This next one is hilarious. Some guy was basically trying to cross-site script Tesla by giving his car a weird name. And sure enough, when it went to the dealership, his blind XSS actually fired. This is gold.
Yeah, this guy, Sam Curry, he had himself a Tesla. Being a bit of a nerd, he decided to change the name a few times, played with the, you know, the user interface trying to trigger some injection bugs, and it didn't get any. Left an XSS Hunter payload as the name of his car. XSS Hunter lets you kind of receive a hook, like a callback, when your payload fires at some point in the future. So it's great for finding these kind of like long-term blind XSS that you end up getting, you know, months after the fact. And yeah, sure enough, he cracked his windscreen, takes it into the dealership, and his XSS Hunter trigger fires, which... Yeah, pretty funny stuff, and really, you know, illustrates the value of this kind of, you know, finding these kinds of bugs with those long term payloads.
Yeah, and he got himself 10 grand, right?
10 grand.
And I can imagine you would have had a few fire off like years later, right? Because I've heard of people like they participate in some bounty that is long since dead, and some back end system finally hits a stored, you know, a blind XSS, and then bing, it's like, the bounty finished 2 years ago. Too bad.
Yeah, no, honestly, it happens. It does happen quite a lot. I mean, sometimes you end up, you know, you test a thing in the test environment, and then you're still getting emails from the production system, you know, in some cases 15 years later, because you just can't, you know.
15 years?
I'm thinking of a particular customer now that I don't want to talk about. But
15 years. Are you serious?
Yeah. Actually, maybe not. Okay, maybe 15 is an exaggeration. Maybe, let me think, realistically, 8.
That's still embarrassingly, like, that's amazing.
The email stop, you're getting this because you are an administrator of, and I'm like, I'm not an administrator, don't send me this. But you try and just, we try and undo these things, but
yeah,
sometimes the business process just can't undo these things, and it's, you know, a reminder sometimes when you're a pen tester to never really commit data to a system that you don't want to live with for the next 25 years. Like, don't, you know, if you're using the burp feature where it used to fill in the forms as Mr. Peter Wiener, you're going to be addressed as Mr. Wiener for the rest of time if you do that. Just don't.
Before we wrap up, we have a reading list item that you contributed this week, Adam. It's a story from The Information, which looks at what Apple did to crack down on thefts of its devices, like, you know, pre-release thefts of its devices from Chinese factories. It's really interesting.
Yeah, it's a great write-up of, you know, how you solve some fairly real-world security problems that are not just technological, right? There's, you know, people digging tunnels out of factories where they make, you know, iPhone components so they can smuggle them out. When they make, apparently they make some of the female employees wear a bra that doesn't have an underwire because there's, you know, gets detected by the metal detection systems to stop you exfiltrating, you know, pieces of iPhone internals out of the factory, which is, yeah, all the sorts of crazy techniques that Apple and the other, you know, other manufacturers have to do to kind of preserve the magic of their product announcements, which, you know, whether that's a reasonable trade-off, I don't know. But yeah, it's a really good write-up of how to solve some of these problems in the real world across, you know, international boundaries and the, you know, the extent that they have to go to if they want to keep these things, you know, from leaking out. And the reasons that they leak too. I thought that was quite an interesting aspect that I didn't really think about. Like the fact that accessory manufacturers for, like, you know, novelty iPhone cases with cats on them will buy pre-release covers so they know how to make theirs, you know, three months. They've got 3 months lead time on the, you know, injection molding jigs over their competitors, which, yeah, I never thought of that.
But it makes sense, right? It makes sense why there's a market for this stuff. But yeah, I like you, when I hit the part where people are tunneling, like Great Escape style,
exactly,
to get into a factory,
like,
you know,
Colbert's, like, Castle is where they make iPhones.
Wild stuff. All right, Adam, this is this concludes the second taping of this week's show because as I announced on Twitter earlier today, we actually had a technical problem that rendered the first recording completely useless. So that's never happened really in the last 10 years or something. So sorry about that. And thank you very much for doing it all again.
No problem. It's always better after the dress rehearsal anyway.
It is. Easier edit for sure. So thanks again. Double, triple, quadruple thank you, Adam. And I'll chat to you again next week.
Yeah, thanks much, Pat. I'll talk to you then.
That was Insomnia Security's Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. And yep, we did it twice this week. Big thanks to Adam for making that work because, you know, he has another job to do as well. So, buddy, really appreciate it. And I'm sure all of our listeners do too. It's time for this week's sponsor interview now with Casey Ellis of BugCrowd. Casey is a founder of BugCrowd and now serves as its CTO. And he's joining me this week to talk about a couple of things that actually dovetail quite nicely. Regular listeners would know that there was a recent RCE in the Zoom video conferencing software that was originally uncovered during a bounty program run by a third party. It wasn't actually run by Zoom. It was run by a company that uses Zoom quite a lot. Now, as you'll hear, third-party bounties, where companies have bug hunters look into the software they regularly use, are becoming more common. And further to that, BugCrowd is actually launching a new product for companies that operate marketplaces that will let them get apps for their marketplaces. You know, these are third-party developed things. They can get those apps tested by the crowd before they wind up in app stores, which seems like a, you know, pretty sensible product. So I started off by asking Casey if third-party tests are becoming, you know, a bit of a thing these days, and here's what he had to say.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the caveat to that is, you know, they need to be able to give permission to test the thing that they're commissioning the testing on. But yeah, for sure. I think the idea of, you know, getting more eyes on target, you know, being able to understand like what the risk is of different, you know, installable or even physical devices they're using, you know, those pieces of software, getting validation of that. We're starting to see more of that. It's definitely, you know, I wouldn't say it's a common thing at this point, but that trend has definitely kicked off at this point, and I expect it to increase.
Yeah, so I mean, it's a little bit different to someone commissioning a bug bounty on Zoom's website, right? Like, you can't really do that. But for installable software, network appliances, whatever, you know, I'm just wondering, is there any real growth there, or is it just something that's always kind of been on the margins because people want to look after their own stuff first?
Yeah, I think this comes back to the whole idea of like disclosure being different from crowdsourcing. You know, like we as a vendor are delivering a bug bounty product in terms of how bug bounties are thought of traditionally out there in the market, as well as a vault disclosure product. But what we're also doing is understanding who can do what. And like that's the fundamental issue that a lot of companies have, like getting, you know, the right access to people that can, you know, effectively get in there and break this stuff and give them a proper, you know, idea of where their risk actually is. Like if this is a way to do that, you know, they're going to take that option. And yeah, to your question before, like we are seeing more of that as we go forward.
Yeah. Okay. And does that create some interesting questions for you? Because I'd imagine like, you know, if you've got one of your customers commissioning tests on products made by another customer, like you could probably wind up in some interesting situations there.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, that's the, call it the opportunity that we have to be able to get ahead of those sorts of conversations and make sure that there's a degree of shared or, you know, set expectation.
So it might actually work out well, right? Because everybody's kind of on the same page. Yeah.
You know, where we're up to right now is that that particular kind of collision, you know, scenario that you just called out hasn't happened yet. But if it was to happen, like we've seen different variations of that in the past without people coming in and saying, hey, go hack this other company's stuff. And really what we've done at that point is actually used, to your point, the relationships that we have with both to make the whole process smoother.
Yeah. So it's almost a better result, I guess, than when you've just got, you know, bugs to report in some completely unrelated company who's going to get really angry and
yeah, the alternative is you've got this very chaotic communication process and no one really knows who's going to talk to who, when, and you know, like that can work out sometimes, other times it doesn't. Like I think reducing the risk and what channels are established at the entry point of that conversation is probably not a bad thing, right?
Now, you are also launching something new, Bug Crowd. I keep forgetting what it's called. Is it Bug Crowd for Marketplaces? Or what's the name?
Bug Crowd for Marketplaces. So essentially, it's addressing this idea of, you know, the trend towards organizations having third-party applications delivered through their platform to their users, but written by someone who's not them.
Okay, so like, you know, if you got your Splunk add-ons, you've got Palo Alto also have an app store. Yeah, that sort of stuff, right?
Yeah, like yeah. Google Play, like, you know, the Atlassian, there's a whole bunch of different versions of that kind of phenomena out in the market. And what we saw was the fact that this is growing as a trend.
Yeah.
It becomes, you know, a useful way for people to consume IT, get introductions to new features and functionality on.
That's a smart idea, right? If you could somehow create a crowdsourced sort of moderation of some of these bigger marketplaces, but like the resources that would be required to clean up some of the bigger ones, like I'm thinking like the Play Store, you know, there aren't enough hackers in the world to fix that one.
Yeah. And like ultimately what it comes down to is understanding the scope of the problem in the first place. Cause I think if you have a good read on that, then you can justify the expense of creating those resources. But in the absence of that information, like who's to know? So like, that's really what it comes down to. Like, how do we become a validation point for, you know, the acceptance of a new app into a store, you know, be that a public store or be that even like a private cloud environment that people are running?
It's interesting that you talk about it from the point of, you know, at the time of acceptance, because I get the feeling that the sort of legacy technical debt in something like, and I'm just going to keep using the Play Store because it's the obvious example, but the technical debt there can never be paid off, right? So you got to sort of start now and let the rest bleed out.
Well, I think the first things need to come first, right? Like as a you know, marketplace owner, yeah, the first question that you need to ask is, do I want to accept this third-party vendor into my ecosystem, because if they screw up, it's going to reflect on me. It's not my fault necessarily in terms of my own development team, but you know, I am kind of the proxy acceptor of that risk, and that becomes my responsibility. So how do we help them get over that first hurdle? And, you know, to your point, I think going forward from that, it really becomes a question of like, how do you take this process and make it continuous for organizations to be able to clear that debt over time? Because, yeah, you're right. Like oftentimes these things are pushed to market, you know, pretty quickly. There's problems with them and whatever else. And like our job becomes identifying where those problems are so that they can be resolved.
Yeah, I think that's interesting because I'd imagine the obvious place for you to start would be less your Google Play stores and more your sort of Palo Alto, Splunk. And, you know, I mean, they're the two sort of enterprise examples I can think of, but there are others. I mean, are you planning on starting with those niche enterprise marketplaces and then moving on from there?
There'll be some stuff coming out later this week, you know, as we head off into Hacker Summer Camp and do all that stuff. You know, and it really kind of talks to our focus on this product, and it is the enterprise. Like the whole idea of, okay, as an enterprise, you're accepting an extension to this broader thing that you've acquired, and you want to, you know, increase the utility and do all that stuff. But how can you know at that point that the third party that you're now working with as well is secure as a part of that whole relationship? So, yeah.
So how is this different to just running a bug bounty for every new thing that comes through to your app store? Is there some sort of process difference? Like how do you differentiate this from a regular bounty?
Yeah. So like there's two things. The first, you know, in terms of the initial experience is it's really this idea, you know, I think we talked about this the last time that we got together, the whole idea of like Uber for hackers, right? Like push button, get hackers, get answers to questions that you need answers to at that point in time as they relate to security. That's what this process looks like because, you know, there's all sorts of different third-party apps that could become a part of these types of processes. And really our job is to be able to deliver the right people to answer questions as they relate to security that are being asked at that point. The second piece, which is probably more interesting, is this idea of, you know, a bug bounty being something that your grandma can understand, right? Like you talk to like the average concerned citizen at this point around cybersecurity, like everyone's kind of worried about it. But if you try to explain how a firewall works or, you know, next generation antivirus or whatever, you'll lose them pretty quickly. But this idea of like neighborhood watch for the internet and the fact that we can go out to a broad group of people that have the ability to, you know, give feedback.
Yeah, so look, I guess it comes down to, you know, just the same with your next generation pen tests and whatever. It comes down to packaging, really. And that's not, you know, that's not to dismiss its value. A lot of the different product lines you've got, you know, coming out of Bug Crowd, they do come down to essentially to packaging and process, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think, you know, it's an interesting one to answer because at the same time that I don't want to dismiss the different ways that we can deploy the crowd, like, part of our job as well is to extend from this adjacent kind of, or this core thing rather, that we've figured out that vuln disclosure and bug bounty, as it's commonly known, that's a good thing. Like, how do we increase the different use cases that we can deploy the crowd out into? And this is one of those. So like what we're doing with this particular product, you know, in the case of someone who engages with this type of model, the mothership, so to speak, is the one who pays for the program. But the owners of the packages or the software, you know, whatever it might be, are the ones that pay for the bounties. And it's partly...
No, I get it. It makes a lot of sense. If you want to get into our marketplace, you have to do this.
Yeah. And being able to support that as, you know, something that's not necessarily an intuitive extension of this model, but seems, you know, to us as a logical way to deploy the crowd to be able to make this whole thing go faster and be better. That's the goal. The core concept behind Bug Crowd and how we've always tried to play this thing out is to grow out from the core into the adjacencies. It's not just about vuln disclosure and bug bounty. It's about this idea of, you know, the ability to connect the right hackers with the right problems. Like that's part of the future of work, I believe, in this space.
Well, Casey Ellis, it sounds like you've got, you know, a bit of a launch there, and I look forward to seeing the customer details when they are unveiled. It's been a pleasure to chat to you as always. Thanks a lot for joining us, and thanks a lot for sponsoring Risky Biz.
You're welcome. Cheers.
That was Casey Ellis there from Bug Crowd with a chat about third-party bug bounty testing. Big thanks to him for that. And big thanks to Bug Crowd for its continued support of the Risky Business Podcast. And that's it for this week's show. We will be back next week with more news and analysis. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.